Okay, it's time to start. I know more will be coming on as we go through today's class, but it's already 9 o'clock, so we need to get started. Today is November 30th, 2015, and it's the fifth class this semester, which makes it six and a half, actually, focusing on Rabbi Hanan Wasserman. One second. Okay, everyone. I want to pick up exactly where we left off. And that is the last thing I said was that when Rabbi Hanan was in America, one of his interesting comments was that he actually found religious life here more impressive and better than it was back in Poland. So he definitely was very down on religious life in Poland. People often have this perception that things were really great, Jewish life in Poland, when the truth is the exact opposite was the case. And already in the by World War II, in the big cities, they were majority irreligious. And the Hasidim were able to hold on to many of their youngsters much more successfully than the non-Hasidic element in Lithuania. But the truth is that even the Hasidic element had suffered a great deal. And as I said, the fact that the big cities were majority irreligious shows you which direction the winds were blowing. Rabbi Hanan came, as I said, in October of 38, and he remained till March of 1939, and then he returned to Europe, as he always planned to return to Europe. Anyone, or most people who've been to yeshivas and know something about Rabbi Hanan, there is this myth, this, I don't know what else you call it, a story, that Rabbi Hanan was, he had a choice. That is, he was told, he was begged not to go back to Europe, and instead he went back to Europe, and even knowing the great danger and that maybe a danger to his life, I remember being told he went back, quote, to die with his students. I mean, all sorts of crazy things like that, which halakhically are obviously very problematic, but then historically they don't make any sense. But there is this tradition, this story that he went back to be with his students with the Nazis. I mean, some people assume that the war was even going on. And none of that is true at all. He went back in March 39 when there wasn't any reason to think there was any problem, any reason not to go to Poland. Obviously, Europe was not the best place to be in. But I don't know why. I don't know if you can see this. This thing keeps popping up about the named hosts. Ignore that, though. So he goes back to Europe as he was the plan for him to go back. But let me read you what appears in the Art Scroll book on Rav Hanan, which is a translation of the Hebrew. This is on page 359. It says that he, that is Rav Hanan, had decided that it was his duty to return to Poland despite the danger and even at the cost of his life. I mean, well, what do you mean at the cost of his life? This is March of 39. There were no one's life was in danger in Poland in March of 39. In retrospect, we could say that, but at the time, no one assumed that. In spite of the many cogent arguments made in favor of his remaining, he was afraid of yielding to persuasion, etc., etc. When asked why he was going back, he said, "I'm a soldier, I have to go to the front." Furthermore, this even reaches a more extreme sentiment. I have this book by a man named Urbach, Urbach, called Kol Korei Bamidbar. This book, if you Google it, you'll get a number of posts about it, a number of hits, because when this book came out about a year ago or 2 years ago, it made the Haredi news, and it had to be withdrawn from circulation. That is, the author requested that all the books be brought back to him. So, of course, anytime there's a book that's has to be withdrawn from circulation, I have to make it my business to get a hold of it because it's now a collector's item and I have a copy. And the reason why it was withdrawn was because he attacks Breslov Chasidus. And that was too controversial, apparently. But it's an interesting book, quite apart from that, because it's analysis of the yeshiva world outlook. It's actually, in a sophisticated fashion, it put forth a defense for the Lithuanian yeshiva world's outlook approach. And that's why I found it interesting. I didn't care about the Breslov stuff at all. But on page 182, he, I mean, just to show you that it's a bit of a sophisticated book, you wouldn't get this in most Haredi books that have, because most Haredi works have no appreciation or even knowledge of general historical events. But he begins by talking about the story of General Santa Anna, the dictator of Mexico, etc., etc., and the whole. I mean that a reference like that would go over most people's head, but he says that the point of this is to talk about that a general doesn't leave his troops, and he says that he develops the idea that in the Lithuanian approach was that they remained with their students, which was the case mostly, and he says unlike the Hasidim who left, you know, who left them in Europe and saved themselves, gives us an example, Rav Yochanan Wasserman. Who returned from America to Lita, to Lithuania? Truthfully, he didn't return to Lithuania, he returned to Poland to be with the yeshiva. Now, the truth of the matter is, Rav Yochanan is a good example of this, but not because he returned from New York to Poland. That's neither here nor there. He remained with the yeshiva, even though he could have left once the war started. So, Rav Yochanan, his actions during the war are perfect examples of a general not leaving. The battlefield of a captain not leaving the ship. He remains, as we'll see, with the yeshiva, even though he could have left. And that's the example that he should have given instead of this phony example of him coming back from America in March of 39. He doesn't mention the year, because if he mentioned the year, people would say, you know, this doesn't make sense. It's not like he's returning to a war zone. As for the Hasidic rabbis, he says, and it's true, that there was this idea in Hasidus that the most important thing is to save the Rebbe. So that even if the rest of the people die, the most important thing is to save the Rebbe. I think it was the Gerer Rebbe, or someone even, or maybe the Belzer, I think it was the Gerer, though, that someone took his place, made believe he was the Rebbe. For the Hasidim, the most important thing is for the Rebbe to survive, and I guess for the Rebbe himself. So you'll find that on page 182. Now, before we return, we'll return to the history in a few minutes. Let me just mention, and we'll pick up with this more when we finish the history. But in 19, while in the United States during this time of 38 and 39, Rav Yochanan wrote and published an important Yiddish booklet that we'll look at in more detail in a few minutes, called Ikvasa de Mashiach. You know, the footsteps of the Messiah. That is, the name implies that we're on the verge of the Messianic era. Even though when he was in Marienbad, he said that the creation of a state would not be in the Sechalta of the Geula, it would be the beginning of the redemption, it would be you know, a deeper golos, a deeper exile. He says he sees with the war clouds coming and all the problems, he sees this as the footsteps before the Messianic era. And in this work, he wants to explain why things are happening the way they are. I mean, the major theme of the book, in addition to criticism of all the terrible things going on, is the need for repentance. The book has appeared in Hebrew, it appeared in English, a complete English translation. There's also been excerpts translated into English. In the book, he speaks against the various ideologies, the so-called isms that Jews have been drawn to. Haskalah, liberalism, democracy, socialism, because of the Jews have been drawn to both socialism and nationalism, he says that they're now being punished by an ideology that combines them both, that is national socialism, which is a combination of the two. Before I go further, and yeah, Moshe says he says it would provoke the Messianic era through the birth pangs. I want to call attention to one other point, which I forgot at the beginning. And this is also relevant to Ikvasa de Mashiach. The comment was made last class by Moshe and also Naftali Hirsch of Vesely that when I said that Rabbi Hanan does not use the three oaths as an anti-Zionist argument, both of them pointed out that he does mention the three oaths. And I actually checked both sources that he mentions it. It's very easy to find because there's a, although they sent, one of them sent them to me, but there's also an index at the back of his collected writings. And if you look at both of them, both passages that mention the three oaths relate to the point I'm going to talk about right now, rebellion against the nations. He does not mention the three oaths with reference to the anti-Zionist oath, that is, Jews are not to go up to the land in force. And my point was that he didn't use the three oaths in the Satmar fashion, that is, as an argument against establishing a state, against settling the land, things like that. And so I stand, I don't, I, last class I said I stand corrected if that's the case. This class I say I don't need to be corrected. What I said was correct, that he uses the three oaths, but not in an anti-Zionist fashion. Rather, he uses it in a Gullus, what you would say maybe a Gullus mentality fashion, and I'll get to that right now. Because the first time he uses this is when he speaks against the boycott. He, Rabbi Hanan spoke out against those who were in favor of a boycott. He spoke out, as we said, against anyone who's in favor of challenging publicly the anti-Semites. Now, in terms of the boycott, he alludes to this. He says that there are people in our day who have declared war on mighty states. The mighty states, this refers to Germany. And he says this is not the Jewish way. The Jewish way is to fight anti-Semitism not with protests, but with quiet diplomacy. There is no question that what Rabbi Hanan is saying is the historical approach. This idea that you declare boycotts and mass rallies and protests and everything, that is never the way that in the past Jews protested and fought against anti-Semites. Now, regarding the boycott, let's take a minute to talk about it in and of itself, because it's interesting. This goes back to 1933, although the boycott propaganda continued throughout the 30s. The Agudas HaRabbanim in Poland, the very country that Rabbi Hanan was living in, they came out in favor of the boycott. So it's not just the irreligious or the Zionists who've lost the Torah way, as it were, but the rabbis, the Agudas Rabbanim, the organization of rabbis in Poland, came out in favor of the boycott. Rav Chaim Ozer Gruzinski, who was also in Poland, because at this time in the 30s, Vilna was part of Poland, he opposed the boycott. He said that his reason for opposing it is different than Rabbi Hanan. He said that even opponents of the boycott knew that it would not help the Jews of Poland, the Jews of Germany, that is. What's the story with the boycott? Well, immediately upon Hitler coming to power, you know, he instituted anti-Semitic decrees, so Jews wanted to show that you know, Jews are not going to take it, that we're going to have a boycott. But they recognized, most at least recognized, that this would not really... is not the way you're going to, unless it's an absolute boycott. And you never really have, there's always people who are opposing it, especially in 1933. Many Jewish organizations opposed the boycott because they thought it would hurt the Jews of Poland. But there were those who said that we still need to do the boycott because we need to show other anti-Semitic countries. For example, Poland was very anti-Semitic. Romania. There was talk about banning Shlita in Poland. So by having the boycott as a response to Hitler's actions, he banned Shlita almost immediately. It became assuming power, this would show the other countries that if you ban, you know, you take anti-Semitic measures, you ban Shlita or anything else like that, there will be a price to pay. Rav Chaim Ozer says we cannot support a boycott for this reason, because, you know, the Talmud says that you can't kill X to save Y. He said we can't sacrifice Germany. That is, if we have this boycott, which is going to hurt Germany because the Nazis are going to take it out on against the Jews, it's going to hurt the Jews economically. We can't do that in order to, you know, to save the Jews of Poland, even though many people thought that we need to show the rest, you know, Germany might be finished as far as our influence on it, but the rest of the world, the rest of Europe, we need to show that Jews are not going to take it, you know, laying down. Rav Chaim Ozer opposed it. But once the Polish Agudas Rabbanim expressed their approval of the boycott, Rav Chaim Ozer agreed not to publicly oppose the boycott. That is, he kept quiet, although he was opposed to the boycott. However, his brother-in-law, Rabbi Hanan, had a different approach, and he did not remain quiet. And he said and continued to say that this boycott is not a Torah perspective, and he opposed the boycott. And the reason he opposed it is because he said that Jews are forbidden to rebel against the nations of the world. That's one of the three oaths. And this is not the Torah way. And I mean, well, why does he need to be, if there's a Masorah, if there's a tradition that Jews work quietly with the Shtadl on quiet diplomacy, why do you need to cite the Talmud? Because I think the citing of the Talmudic passage is just to show you where this tradition comes from. that Jews don't make public scenes. They don't have rallies in Washington. They don't do anything like that. Everything is because it's going to be negative. It's going to cause repercussions. Everything has to be done in a quiet mentality. It is true that this is a Gullus mentality. I think you all would agree with that. Rabbi Hanan would say it's a Gullus mentality. He'd agree with that. After all, we're in Gullus, and therefore you have to have a Gullus mentality. I'll read you in a little while what he says about precisely when we are in the Gullus, we have to have this Gullus mentality of kissing up to the rulers and using the quiet approach. But in this mentality, even Nazi Germany is a government which must be respected, and you must treat it as any government. That is, you must approach them with respect, and quiet diplomacy is the only way you can change things, not through open confrontation. And remember what we said, that Jews cannot rebel. Nazi Germany is even regarded as a government which has a certain legitimacy that Jews are forbidden to rebel against it. That is, and it's not killing Jews or anything at this moment. It's persecuting Jews, but Jews have been persecuted throughout history, and Jews know how to respond to persecution. I mean, in the Satmar mentality, the Holocaust is a direct result, at least according to some of them, and this is part of the major myth in Satmar writings, that because the Jews chose to respond differently than in the past, that is, because they chose to oppose Hitler openly through protests and things like that, that's what led to the Holocaust. Had the Jews not adopted this open approach of confrontation, things would have been able to be settled in a much calmer fashion, a quiet fashion. Yes, Jews would have still been treated in a disrespectful way. However, it wouldn't have angered Hitler and it wouldn't have angered the Nazis. And one of the lessons that the Satmar mentality people derive from the Holocaust is precisely the problems of public confrontation and their approaches. Had we followed the true and time-tested method of quiet diplomacy, there never would have been a Holocaust. This idea that you can't rebel against the nations and that the Nazi government is, even Nazi Germany is a government that must be respected. When I say respected, I don't mean respect that you feel good about it. I mean you have to follow the laws and treat them the way you treat other governments. It just shows the difference in mentality for today. Let me give you an example here. Let's say the United States issued anti-Semitic decrees. Today, let's say they issued decrees that Jews can't vote or Jews have to pay higher taxes. I think every one of us would assume that this is no longer the country we know, and we no longer need to be loyal to it. Because any country that could issue an anti-Semitic decree is not a country that is, it's not a legitimate government. It's not a legitimate country. We don't need to have any loyalty to it. And yet the fact is that the laws of Dina Demalchus Adina, that is, we must obey the laws of the lands, they're not voided because of government anti-Semitism. Every government in history, until the United States, and perhaps not even at the beginning of the United States, was either officially or de facto anti-Semitic. In fact, officially, every government in history, prove me wrong, I don't think it can be, every government in history until the establishment of the United States was officially anti-Semitic. The United States was not officially anti-Semitic, although in practice, obviously, there was anti-Semitism, both governmental in some parts of the country, as well as obviously from people, but governmentally as well. Every country in Europe had rules against Jews being involved in public life, etc. Did anyone ever say that Dina Malchus Adina doesn't apply, the law of the land? These laws were established and derived and developed under Rome, and under Babylonian rule. These were terribly anti-Semitic countries. No one ever thought that, the law of Dina Malchus Adina doesn't apply. What about medieval times? What about, in the 1600s, 1700s, all these countries were anti-Semitic, and Jews were in ghettos and other things, and yet they were still, no one said the laws of Dina Malchus don't apply. Moshe said, what about Holland? What about Holland? When Holland was ruled by all sorts of countries, the Jews never had complete freedom there. Yes, it's true that later on, Jews were treated better in the era of Spinoza, but Jews were not able to be involved in government, and there was all sorts of rules against Jews in these countries. America was the first. So no one ever assumed that because a government is anti-Semitic, that the rules of Dina Malchus don't apply. In fact, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Moshe Isserles, take a look. 396, six, that is Siman 396, number six, you'll see that even if the government taxes the Jews more than non-Jews, which was usually the case, it still falls under the category of Dina de Mahusa Dina, the law of the land is the law. So everyone always assumed that. They did make a distinction between Dina de Mahusa Dina, the law of the land, and thievery. Choshen Mishpat, Shlomo Choshen Mishpat, thievery. If the government is completely destroying the Jewish community through reckless thievery and trying to destroy them this way, then this is a chamsa. Then all of a sudden you don't need to follow it because that's already too much extremism. And I know that Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer said that the Soviet Union, there was no obligation to follow their rules because it was thievery of the king, not the law of the king. But in general, you need to follow the rules. And that's what Rabbi Chanan was saying. He wasn't saying this in 1939, 1940. But before then, he was saying this is still a legitimate government. It's a persecuting government, obviously, but it's still a legitimate government. We cannot rebel against it, and we need to follow the tried and true methods. Through the Shtadlan, through quiet diplomacy, because Jews have never dealt with anti-Semites by confronting them. By the way, reflecting a similar mentality, the Gerer Rebbe, who also was opposed to the ban, he suggested bribing the Nazis. And when you see something like that, it's I mean, the naivete is worth taking note of because the Gerer Rebbe is responding to the Nazis as if this is some petty ruler, petty mayor or local figure in Tsarist Russia that you can bribe, not recognizing that the Nazis were a completely different phenomenon. Now, obviously, as Moshe points out, if religious practice is threatened, of course there's no Dina de Mahusa Dina. If the non-Jews, as we're in the Hanukkah season here, if they declare that we can't circumcise our children, of course there's no obligation. If they say that Shchita is banned, we don't need to follow that. But simply a little bit of anti-Semitism never voided Dina Malchusa. Although I made the claim years ago, and I don't think it's, I made it on these classes, I think, and I don't think it's crazy that although historically anti-Semitism never voided Dina Malchusa, I think that what I said before, that if the United States issued anti-Semitic decrees, that it wouldn't void it, Dina Malchusa, it might not be correct. Because think of all these other governments. These other governments are, by definition, anti-Semitic governments. They favor the Catholics or the Christians. They have negative views about Jews. Jews are in ghettos. But if you take, let's say America, which is based on the idea of freedom and democracy and equality, if you'd have a situation where someone was elected or they did something and they changed the rules, and all of a sudden America then starts discriminating on the basis of religion, you could say that it's no longer America anymore, and that is the country America no longer exists. It's simply a dictator, and therefore you're not bound. You never. This dictator is an interloper. Or the people running the country are interlopers, and maybe they don't have the status of a legitimate government. And maybe you can make the case, halachically, that is, that Dina de Malchusa Dina doesn't apply. But the idea, which we have, that in general, well, hey, if the government's anti-Semitic, we wouldn't need to follow it, that is not historically correct. Now, in response to Rabbi Hanan's point that Jews are forbidden to rebel against the nations, Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski is known to have responded that the Jews are also a nation. As Rabbi Chanan said that you can't rebel against the nations, Rav Chaim Ozer said the Jews are also a nation. In other words, there comes a point when the Jews too can defend themselves. They don't have to take it laying down. Rav Chaim Ozer was opposed to the boycott because he thought it would have negative repercussions against the Jews of Germany. But he was not opposed to it for the reason that Rabbi Chanan gave, that the Jews need to take it. They can't publicly organize or anything like that. That, as he said, we too are a nation. So he had a different perspective. There were, by the way, other leading rabbis who supported the boycott. We spoke about last class from Yehuda Leib Tzirilson. Yehuda Leib Tzirilson, not only did he support the boycott, Yehuda Leib Tzirilson is one of the few rabbis who had a broad secular education. He read, if you read his, look at his book of Drashot, I forget what it's called, not Gevul Yehuda, I forget the name of it, but if you look at his Drashot, you'll see that he cites all these secular works of literature. And in his essay dealing with the boycott, he says that we can tighten the screws so much about so much on. I'll get to all the questions and comments afterwards. You can tighten, but he says you can tighten the screws so much on Nazi Germany, we will turn it into like Dante's Inferno, he mentions. Just like imagine Dante's Inferno, Levi Huda will make it into Dante's Inferno. So the fact that he cites Dante, I mean, most rabbis reading it won't even know who Dante is. This comment of Rav Chaim Ozer is mentioned by Rabbi Henkin in one of his essays. I refer to it in I give the source in my book on Rabbi Weinberg. Okay, let's return now to his visit to America. I'll come back to when we deal with the rest of the history, and unfortunately his martyrdom. I'll come back to Ikvas of the Mashiach as well. He traveled, as I said, all over, going as far west as Denver. He made it to Scranton. He also made it to Baltimore. And if you look in the collected writings, there's a very interesting essay signed by the rabbis of Baltimore, in which when he was there, he heard about a dance, a mixed dance that was taking place in the community. And he wrote a short essay in opposition to it, which was signed by the rabbis of Baltimore. This sort of thing, of course, in those days was very common. People today don't believe you if you tell them this, but there's plenty of people whose grandparents might have met at Young Israel dances. Young Israel put on dances. That was a way they thought of keeping the Jewish boys and girls, mingling and socializing with one another. It's funny you say it today because Young Israel has become quite right wing, but Young Israel was founded precisely because they didn't want rabbis of the old European sort. Mordechai Kaplan was involved with this. They wanted a completely new perspective, and it's a very big change. But one of the things the Young Israel was known for were the Young Israel dances. Rabbi Ochanan, as I said, returns in March of 1939, and on his way back, he stops in London. And he actually is in London for Pesach. And while there, people said to him, "Move your. There's no future in Poland. Poland, the stuff that was going on in Poland. I mean, Shlita by then, by 39, I think, in April, I think it already even been banned or was about to be banned. I mean, the conditions in Poland were terrible." So he was asked to move his yeshiva to London. Now, according to the stories, Rabbi Ochanan did think war was inevitable. But again, what does that mean? War was inevitable. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg in 1937 writes that war is inevitable. But what does that mean? War is inevitable. The fact that there's going to be a war, that Germany is going to invade a country and try to take back territory, that has nothing to do with the idea of an extermination of the Jews. No one could ever imagine anything like that. And truth be told, Jews in Poland in 1939 would have much preferred to be taken over and live under German rule, under the Nazis, than they would under Soviet rule. Because under Nazi Germany, things were bad, obviously, but at least you could still live as a Jew. I'm talking about actually before, let's say before Kristallnacht. But the Soviet Union, as we spoke about, within the space of 15 years, that was it for Judaism in the Soviet Union. So in London in 1939, we get the following dialogue, which is recorded in the biography of him. When he's asked, why not, have the yeshiva come to London? London's safe, London's calm, economically London was much better. There was no reason for any Jew to be living in Poland in 1939. It was all bad news. So what does Rabbi Ochanan say? That you can move furniture from one place to another, but you cannot move the cobwebs. And the explanation for this in the book is, quote, he was alluding to the particular atmosphere that had been created within the walls of his yeshiva over a period of years. This ambience could not be transplanted in a country that was not a normal environment for Torah study. So his point was that with all the problems in Poland, there at least you can have a yeshiva. It's the traditional environment. I can't move a yeshiva to a place like London. It's a completely new environment. It'll destroy the sense of what it is to have a yeshiva. Of course, as we'll see in just a couple of years, Rabbi Ochanan wanted very much to move the yeshiva out of Poland to America or anywhere else. But in 1939, there was no sakarat nefashot, there's no danger to life, there's no reason to move the yeshiva because, yes, economically things are bad and all sorts of reasons, religiously things are bad in Poland, But that's still the best environment for the yeshiva. I'm actually a little surprised that this would be recorded in an art scroll biography, which is a translation from the Hebrew, because what it shows is that the Torah sages did not know what was coming, and that they didn't realize they had a chance to move the yeshiva and save everyone, but they didn't know what was coming. Now, that is obviously not a criticism. How could they have known? There's no reason to assume anything bad is coming. But from I guess the extreme Haredi perspective, where the Gedolim are supposed to have this insight into everything, the fact that you quote Rav Chanan saying in April of 39 or March of 39 that there's no reason to move the yeshiva, that shows a lack of forethought. Again, that this is not a criticism. The Chazon Ish said, he's quoted as saying that there was Hester Panim. God took away the knowledge of the sages. So even from a Haredi perspective, this is not a criticism, but it does show that Rabbi Hanan was completely unaware of what was coming and didn't see the problem, as no one did. Rabbi Hanan is actually back in London 7 weeks later, Shavuos of 1939. I mean, these trips were designed to raise money. When he came back, he was in around this time. He was also in Kovno, we're told, which is independent Lithuania. And again, people asked him, "Are you going to move the yeshiva? Are you going to leave somewhere?" And he says, "Where can we go to? America, Argentina? The Messianic era will encompass all these localities. And if not, who wants to be there?" So he's thinking that everything that's under the surface. The war that seems to be coming, this is going to encompass any and everywhere. Again, we see he's asked, why not go to Argentina? Why not go to America? And his response is, you won't be safe there. And of course, you would have been safe there. This is why I find it strange that this is still published. What else? Okay, let's move on. As we'll see, when the situation got really bad, he did move. Let's turn to now. I think I want to turn now to Ikvasa de Mashiach and some of his other ideas in it. Actually, no, let me turn. Before I get to that, let's finish up the story, which doesn't have a happy ending. When you look at great rabbis and Hasidic rabbis, so many of them were able to leave. And Rav Ochanan, as we'll see right now, he didn't leave. And he could have left, he could have stayed. He could have stayed in London. He didn't have to go back. And once the war started, he could have left, but he chose to remain. Germany invades Poland, of course, in September of 39, and Rav Ochanan and the yeshiva students travel east. Almost immediately, everyone realized that you don't want to be anywhere near Germany. Whereas a year before, Germany wouldn't have been so terrible, perhaps. After all, Poland was nothing special either. After Kristallnacht, the propaganda from the 1939, everyone realized that if not extermination, bad things were coming from. Actually, they didn't realize extermination, but they knew bad things were coming with Hitler. So they began to move east. And many Jews went east, and many Jews survived by going east. And they came under Russian control. And there was movement. During this period, the Russians were taking over land. You could move. He then brings the yeshiva. When they traveled, not just the his yeshiva, Baranovich, but all the yeshivas, they traveled as units. And that's what the Orbach book was talking about. It wasn't every man for himself. It's quite incredible when you look at the history and how the yeshivas traveled together as yeshivas. You couldn't imagine a university being like that. No, it would be every man for himself. It says something wonderful that the yeshivas, Rav Ochanan could have very easily, and any of these yeshivas could have said, this is now a chaotic time. Everyone should return home, stay safe. Hopefully things will pass and we'll be able to get together. No, this was really loco parentis. They moved together and he brought them to Vilna, which was under Soviet control. In the early days of the war, the Russians moved into Vilna. Then they turned Vilna over to Lithuania, and Lithuania was in control of it for, I think it's 8 months or so, and then the Soviet, or 10 months, then the Soviets moved back into it. But from October of 1939, Vilna was once again under the control of the independent Lithuanian government. Revarun Cutler was in Vilna at this time, and a number of other figures. The Briskarov comes to Vilna. The truth of the matter is that the Das Torah, what all the great rabbis and what the Briskarov and others told people was not to leave, that things would be okay in Vilna. And the Mir Yeshiva, when they leave, they actually go against, when they go to, when they leave and head out to, with the Sugihara visas, they were actually going against the viewpoint of the great rabbis who were consulted. I don't know what that says about the doctrine of Das Torah. You could say they had their own Das Torah, but most people stayed. And as I said, there was people were told by great rabbis, there's no reason to leave, and it's dangerous to leave, and you're going to go to Japan. I mean, what kind of place is that for a Jew to be? Rav Elchanan had gone to Vilna. Actually, he didn't bring the yeshiva to Vilna. Sorry, he brought the yeshiva east. He himself went to Vilna at first because he wanted to see if he could bring the yeshiva to Vilna. And he then, once he's already there and checked it out, he sent word to the students to also come to Vilna. He didn't go back. Even though the students were there, he didn't go back to bring them there. That was going back into Soviet territory. And it was very easy to cross the border in those days illegally. And that's what they did. Now, I want to read you something from 1939. Naftali asked, which great rabbi said there's no reason to leave? The Briskarov, for one, said there's no reason to leave. And this is reported by Rav Yisrael Shapansky in a memoir he wrote. He was in Vilna at the time. And he records that in his memoir. But let me go on first. I want to read you something from 1939 when the war had already broken out. I'm reading it to you because it's in the book. It's in the Art Scroll biography as well, although they don't give you the year. I think it's very sad. I don't mean it to, when, again, it's not about judging anyone, or it's about the fact, knowing the fact that no one knew what the future was going to bring. This is on page 383, and this comes from the Hebrew. From the Hebrew, well, everything in this Art Scroll book comes from the Hebrew a biography. A certain Talmud Chacham came to Rav Elchanan asking for help. He had obtained a letter of appointment as rabbi from an American congregation. This would have entitled him to an exit permit, an American visa, but he had to prove that he had served as a rabbi in Baranovich for the past few years. So he asked Rav Elchanan for the necessary attestation. Again, this is 1939. The friend was confident that Rav Elchanan would help him escape from Europe without the slightest hesitation, but Rav Elchanan held back. How can I help you emigrate to America when you have small children? Here we are in great physical danger, but is it a secret that there is tremendous spiritual danger facing children in America? The friend informed Rav Elchanan Rav Chaim Ozer had already given his approval. Rav Elchanan still had not resolved his doubts. Rav Chaim Ozer is certainly reliable, and he may do as his great intelligence dictates. For myself, however, I hesitate to advise people with school-aged children to emigrate to America. So Rav Elchanan spoke in 1939. Even when caught in a violent storm, the Jew cannot divest himself of the responsibility for the spiritual fate of his children. Now, what Art Scroll doesn't mention, that it appears in the Hebrew biography, is that Rav Elchanan said this when he was in Vilna. When, I mean, the war was already going on, and anyone could see that the situation was dire. But of course, it was dire for the Jews in Poland, and the Jews obviously in Germany. There wasn't a reason to assume, living in Vilna, that they were in danger. I mean, this was an independent Lithuanian country, which was allowed to remain independent by the Soviet Union. So on the one hand, in retrospect, this is a terrible, terrible decision not to help this person escape. We'll see soon enough that Rav Elchanan is doing everything he can to escape and helping anyone to escape. But the fear of going to America with small children, even though America is better than Poland, he still the fear was great. In terms of the Briskarov did himself leave. when things got worse, he left, and he would have told Schepansky also to leave. But when he asked him at that point in time, the answer was not to leave. I mean, things were changing all the time. In every few days, there was rumors, and it was very hard to see clearly. The people living in Lithuania still could leave, some of them, if they had money. You could get a visa to come to America. There are ways to leave, but people didn't realize. Now, when I said about Rav Ochanan, that he wanted to leave, if you look in the very same Art Scroll book, you have a picture, and you have the text of this also in the collected writings from Rav Ochanan, when he asks someone in Israel to get a visa for him and his sons. He says, "I'm not ready to leave, but if things get really bad, I need to have it." And in November of 1939, you'll find a letter from him. This is found in the Collected Writings, Volume 2, page 211, where he inquires about moving the yeshiva to Israel. So already, but from November 1939, he realizes that he might have to move the yeshiva to Israel and he might have to escape. But it wasn't yet dire. Where was the yeshiva? The yeshiva was functioning in a small town outside of Vilna called Troki, Troki. Those who know their Jewish history might recognize this name because there is a Karaite who lived in the city of Troki. And he wrote a work, I forget what's his name, Isaiah of Troki, which is an anti-Christian text, which is reprinted now by Orthodox Jews because there's nothing Karaite about it, but its arguments against Christianity are thought to be helpful against missionaries and things. This did not last very long because in June 1940, the Soviets invaded and took over Vilna. So from November of 39 until 1940, this was an independent Lithuania. There wasn't any reason to assume that you have to leave. I mean, some people were lucky or were smart and they saw what was coming, but most people did not. And the Germans never invaded, by the way. If people are worrying about the Germans invading, it wasn't the Germans in June. It wasn't the Germans. They came later. It was the Soviets. Now, there is a letter which we have from Rav Ochanan. The summer of 1940, after the Soviet invasion. This letter is found in the collected writings, and so it's not like it's an unknown letter. However, I found an actual copy of the letter. Here it is. It's a form letter. The content of the letter is not wasn't new. For example, well, not for example, it's found in volume 2 of the collected writings, page 215. In fact, the letter which I didn't realize this, the letter which I'm holding in my hands is the exact one found on page 215. It comes from the Israel Rosenberg archives. You know, Lansing, I might have sent it to this guy, actually. This the Kovetz Mamari, my. Can't recall now. No, I didn't send it to him. I sent material to someone else. There's a collection at the seminary, JTS, called the Israel Rosenberg Collection. He was a leading rabbi in Agudas Rabbanim. And there are many, many letters there from Rav Chaim Moshe Brzezinski. What I did was I informed the person who put out the collected letters of Rav Chaim Moshe of this collection. He wanted me to make copies of it. I told him I couldn't make copies because there's like 50 letters there. So he, on his own, I'm assuming he went and got it, all the letters, or he sent someone there. But people in the know knew about this collection because YU has the Vada Yeshivos, the committee of the yeshivas that sent all the money for the Yisroel being yeshivas, and this is the Rosenberg collection. So here I see on page 215, he has the exact same letter I have. I remember when I first saw this letter, and he got it because he heard that that was the collection, the important collection. So he went, whoever put out these letters, it just says the yeshiva or Ochanan of named after Ochanan Wasser and put it out. I don't know which individual collected the letters, but I still remember when I found this letter. I found other stuff. I don't see. Who put out the, it doesn't mention an individual. I remember when I saw this letter and I held it in my hand. Even though it's a form letter, if you see it, You see, it's a form letter, and at the top it has Rabbi. It says Kavod. That's typed, and then you put in the name. So he put in Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg, and he would have sent Rabbi Chana would have sent letters to this to many people, just taking the form letter and putting in the name. But I remember when I held this letter, it's almost like my hands were shaking. That because here I'm holding a letter, which sent and signed by Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. I held the original letter. Now, when truthfully, maybe it isn't it, because I'm looking at the signature here. I would have to see other letters to see whether this is Rabbi Chanan himself. I'll do this right now, or one of his students who sent out the letters. I'll be. Let's see. I'll tell you right now, because I have the art scroll has page on page 383. It has his handwriting, and yes, this is. I'm looking at it. I'm looking at the letter here from Rabbi Chanan Wasserman in the art scroll book on page 386, and I'm looking at the signature I have, and it's the exact same signature. So my initial feeling was correct. I held this letter, and I don't know. I mean, it's hard. I've held many, many letters of great rabbis. That's what I do. But the feelings I felt when I held the letter from Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, which was sent out in Tammuz of 1940, I guess June 1940, know that the Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, that these are one of the letters he's sending out, asking for assistance. The feeling was, let me just say, the feeling was overwhelming. It wasn't like holding a letter from any other great rabbi, and I've held plenty of letters of great rabbis. The feeling of holding a letter of someone who would be martyred not long after this, and who was in the situation he was in precisely because he chose to remain with his students. Not that he chose to return to them. I already told you that's nonsense. But the fact that he chose to remain with his students when he could have left Vilna and gone, he could have done all these things. Granted, he didn't know what was coming, but it still was not a. Even when things got bad, he could have found a way out. So many others did. So that was very moving. Now, in this letter, well, let me read it to you. He says to Rabbi Rosenberg, and this is a letter to everyone. He says that we've heard about the wonderful idea that your wonderful idea. So he's not writing this to Rosenberg. He's writing also to other important American rabbis to move the yeshivas, not just our yeshiva, all the great yeshivas, to America. So here in 1940, in Tammuz of 1940, he's saying that this is a wonderful idea, or calls it a Ra'ayon HaKadosh V'Tahor. He's saying that this is like what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did in his day to save, Yochanan ben Zakkai saved Torah. He says, Davar bito matov, uzrizi makdimi. And then he says, I ask you though, that this has to be done immediately for all the yeshivas, kulan yachad, do them all together. Why, not to favor some yeshivas? Truthfully, now that I think of it, this letter is probably written because when Rabbi Chanan heard about the plan to move the yeshivas, Baranovich was probably not one of the yeshivas. If you think about the great yeshivas, you think about Mir, you think about Sabaka, you're thinking about those yeshivas. Baranovich is not one of the great yeshivas, and he's probably writing this letter because he heard about this plan to move it, and he's saying you have to include all the yeshivas. Then he goes on and says, that you should do this, bring everyone involved who can help you, such as Lehman, Lamed Ayin Hey Mem Nun. Who's Lehman? Lehman is Herbert Lehman, none other than governor of New York from 1933 to 1942. So they're saying, go to, you can ask Herbert Lehman to help you. I mean, he's a good Jew, right? And it says, just you should be blessed for all your actions. So in October, November, he was telling this man, you can't go to America because what about your children? It's not a place for a Torah Jew there. Now, look how things have changed. He's in this, he's under in Tammuz, which is, would be good question is what it's the summer of, I'd have to check the exact date. Tammuz of 1940. If anyone can, Tuf Shin, while I'm speaking, if anyone could type in, it's Dalet Tammuz, 1940. What the exact date would that be? And then we'd have a better idea. But he, things are very different now. Okay, he obviously saw it as a kind of nefashos. One more point I want to call your attention to here in the Collected Writings, Volume 2, page 214. Also in 1940, but this is in Adar. So March, let's say, he says he have a letter here. And that's how things remained until June 22nd, 1941. Okay, so Sunday, July 7th. Sunday, July 7th is when he writes this letter. This is a very important point because this is after the Soviets invaded. Soviets invaded in June, and he realizes obviously under Soviet rule there's no future. So now it's time to move the yeshivas. But before that, in when it was an independent Lithuania, it wasn't sakonas nefashos, it wasn't so crucial to move. He remains under Soviet rule for a year. In June 22nd, 1941, the Germans invade Lithuania, who was not along, invade the Soviet Union, which controlled controlled Lithuania. It was not a a long invasion, and the last days of Rabbi Hanan were spent in Kovno. And I mean, there's a you know, there's a story report of his final days, his death. I don't need to go into it. And of course, he is a kadosh, a martyr. You can read. We don't have much information about it, but the story. I mean, what, how much information do you need? I mean, we have the story about how he was in his house and then he went downstairs. And but the, one of the last people to know him was Rav Ashri, Ephraim Ashri from the Kovno ghetto, and he's grabbed on July 6th of 1941, and he's shot and killed on July 8th at the Seventh Fort. It's called, if you in Kovno, if you read Rabbi Ashri's book, you can learn all about the Seventh Fort. Rabbi Hanan is, I think, the greatest of the sages to be martyred in the Holocaust. Some died before the war, before being martyred. Think of the Kovno Rav, who dies and is buried. He was not killed. Rabbi Hanan Wasserman dies in 1940. You have Reb Baruch Ber Leibowitz, and you have a number of them who die shortly before, and a number are able to escape. I think that the other one that comes to mind is, of course, from Menachem Zemba, who's also first level. But I think Rabbi Hanan, in terms of his impact and influence, and in his day, Menachem Zemba was not a political figure. He was not, if you would ask anyone, I think, in 1939, the greatest rabbis in Poland, Menachem Zemba would not be up there with Rabbi Hanan Wasserman. I think in ret I think Rabbi Hanan Wasserman has to stand out as the most, at the time, that if you would ask, the most significant, important rabbi, it would be Rabbi Hanan Wasserman. I mean, there's a lot to talk about Rabbi Nachum Zemba as well, but I think Rabbi Hanan has to be seen as the most significant of the rabbis martyred in the Holocaust. In the book of, in the Art Scroll book, It has some pictures here. Of course, you know Rav, he has one son, Rav Simcha Wasserman, that who was a Talmud Chacham and head of the yeshiva. He had another son. Right at the end of the Art Scroll book, it has his son, another son that survived. This son was in Europe. His name was David Wasserman. Wasn't a rabbi, just a regular person, and he settled in Brooklyn. They're told he had a family. He had a number of children. Stephen Morris Wasserman, Dr. Mina Gillers, Elchanan Meir, and so he had, who had three children. So Rav Simcha Wasserman had no children, as far as I know. Rav David Wasserman, Rav Elchanan's son, had three children. Does anyone know what became of them? I mean, these are he obviously must have great grandchildren alive today, and he had three children. I assume two of them are still alive today, MC Gillers and Mina Gillers and Stephen Morris Wasserman. I've never met descendants of Rav Elchanan Wasserman. Okay, so Mel says that Mina Wasserman was at Barnard when I was at Columbia. So he has, I mean, he has Zera Shel Chaima, as we say. He has descendants. I don't know if the descendants are observant or religious or anything like that. But Rav Elchanan Wasserman, his legacy was able to survive. He wasn't, the family line was not completely destroyed. I want to return now, I have 3 more minutes, and then I'll stop and take questions. Go back to some of his ideas and his writings. We'll need at least one class, probably 2 classes, so he won't even finish this semester, dealing with his ideas, because he has ideas, the Ikkvos of the Mashiach. He has ideas about the nature of the oral law, of Torah Shebaal Peh, important things that we need to discuss, important matters of Torah and of philosophy, of theology. That I was going to discuss. So it has an impact. I'm looking at the time. It doesn't pay for me to begin this. So what I want to do next class is deal with Ikvas of the Mashiach, some more important ideas, speak about his theology, as I mentioned, and his ideas. Maybe we could finish it in one class. I'm not sure. But it doesn't pay for the 2 minutes we have to go any further. So let me answer some of the questions here. Rav Elchanan Wasserman is the first one we've dealt with who was killed in the Holocaust. Naftali Herz Wesley tells us that the working group, this is the Slovakian so-called working group, successfully bribed Eichmann. There's no question that Nazi leaders, including Eichmann, were bribed, and that's what allowed. It wasn't just the whole Kastner train and everything. Lots of money changed hands, and it's unrealistic to think that bribery could have saved anything more than a pittance of a number of Jews, that is, some important people. It could not have changed German policy, but bribery was able to have certain effects. The problem was that you couldn't, money could not go from America in any way to the Nazis. So you had through Switzerland, money was went to Germany. But you can see the problem here. So you're paying, how could you help the enemy here? The Germans themselves agreed that this was the Eichmann had this plan that they'd stop the killing of the Jews, and they'd stop the war on the Western Front, and that if America would provide I think it was 10,000 trucks and all soap and everything, and they would only be used on the Eastern Front. I mean, they had all these ideas, but all these were non-starters. Nothing would ever happen in that respect. In terms of bribery, I mean, it wasn't just that. How did the Lubavitcher Rebbe got out of Latvia through bribery? The Belzer Rebbe, the Gera Rebbe, bribery in then and today could do a lot. It's not just saving people. Those who've been to Bratislava have been to the Chasam Sofer's grave. The grave of the Chasam Sofer was saved through bribery. That's the only reason it still exists. So obviously bribery could help, but how much? Moshe said that the Chacham Tzvi said the same thing, that his son, Rav Yaakov Emden, shouldn't go to London. I guess because things are not so good there. Let's see, who else do we have here? A good point made by Moshe is that you don't want to come to America, but when all the yeshivas come together, then the Rabbi Chanan wouldn't oppose it. That's Shlomo, actually. But I don't think that's the issue here. When it's Sakonas Nefashos, when it's life and death, Rabbi Chanan, of course, would have gone and taken his people to America. That letter he wrote in the 30s when he said that you might feel there's danger, you're going to be drafted. The guy was going to be drafted to the Polish army. He said, don't go to America, because in Poland you have Sakonas Nefashos, danger of life, physical life. In America you have danger of spiritual life. We're not talking about literal that you're going to be killed. It was you're going to be in the army. Once, and it wasn't just once the Germans were involved here, once the Soviet Union was, because you can't be a Jew in the Soviet Union. Once they were under Soviet control, then Rav Ochanan was prepared to leave. But he wasn't prepared to leave when they were under Poland and Lithuania. Gillis, okay. Shlomo says they used to joke around on Artscroll cuts out his family line. Well, I mean, they don't deal with any, they deal with the son. They mention him, they have a picture, and they mention a grandson. They don't deal with anything further, but they don't need to deal with anything further because that's not really relevant to the book per se. They call him the survivor of Dovi because he was in Europe and he survived. And then you have a some letters in the book by Rabbi Simcha Wasserman and Reb David. That these three pages at the end of this book are the only thing that's original to Art Scroll. Everything else is found, and much more is found in the two-volume Hebrew Or Elchanan. And what Art Scroll did take out, I think they took out for politically correct sort of reasons. As I mentioned before, the story that Reb Elchanan, the 1939 story where he told someone, "Don't go to America. I'm not going to give you a letter allowing you to go to America." They tell you it's 1939, but in the original, it says that it was in Vilna. So already you see that that makes it a little bit more problematic from a historical perspective to say that Rav Hanan wouldn't assist him. But for the most part, the Art Scroll book keeps word for word to the, for the Hebrew volume. Naftali Hertz Weisel says that the fact that a Haredim aren't aware of current events or history. He says a collection of Musar's talks by the former Rosh Yeshiva of the Philadelphia Yeshiva, Rabbi Elia Sfei, was published, and he refers to world events. I think every Rosh Yeshiva is aware of world events, but to speak about a Mexican general and to have allusions to Dante and all sorts of things that Yehuda Leib Tzirilson mentions, not only I think do most of these allusions go over people's heads. The Rosh Yeshiva themselves are not aware of it, and I don't know why they need to be aware of it. With an American audience, it's important, I think, to have more of a knowledge, I guess, of world events. Shlomo says the Alexander Rebbe was killed in the Holocaust. That is true. Alexander Hasidus was the second largest Hasidus in Poland. The largest Hasidus was Ger, and we're told that there were some 200,000 Ger Hasidim, or fellow travelers. The Ger Rebbe was the most important individual from a political standpoint in all of Poland. That is, he could influence more people to vote for than any other individual. The second largest Hasidic group in Poland was the Alexander Hasidim. Now, there's no such thing anymore, really, as Alexander Hasidus. I assume in Israel you have a Rebbe, but because they were all killed in the war. The Ger Hasidim, many of them, I don't know, many maybe is an exaggeration, but there were a number of Ger Hasidim living in Eretz Yisrael. The Ger Rebbe was a great lover of Eretz Yisrael. If you read Rabbi Lau's wonderful, wonderful autobiography, you can get some insight into this. But quite apart from that, we know the Ger Rebbe, who visited the land of Israel 5 times in the 20s and 30s, not only did he visit it, he bought a lot of property, Tel Aviv and other places, property that today is worth a lot of money. So the Ger Rebbe, the dynasty, they're millionaires many times over, quite wealthy. But not only did he buy property, he sent Hasidim there. The Ger Rebbe would himself have moved to the land of Israel had it not been for all his Hasidim in Poland. In fact, we are told, it's hard to believe it, but it's recorded, that not only did the Ger Rebbe send Hasidim there, Rav Shlomo Goren's family, by the way, was his father was a Ger Hasid, unmarried women who would wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, whose parents, of course, didn't want them to do this. We are told that the Ger Rebbe would give permission for unmarried women to go to the land of Israel as well. I know it's hard to believe, and maybe it's not true, but it is recorded as such. So there were a number of Hasidim, and therefore, when the Ger Rebbe made it to Eretz Yisrael, he was able to reestablish the dynasty. He didn't live very long. He dies in 1948. He's buried right by Machane Yehuda. You can go see his kever there. But he was able to reestablish a dynasty. The Alexander Rebbe, who was killed and his Hasidim killed, there weren't Hasidim in Israel, so nothing really survives. The Alexander Rebbe, though, is significant for another reason, in that the Alexander Rebbe refused to go along with Agudas Yisrael. If you look at the voting records in Poland, if anyone's interested, by the way, in the voting, you can look in Gershon Bacon's book. Which deal it's Agudas Yisrael in Poland. It's a political study of Agudas Yisrael in Poland, and you'll see there that the Alexander Hasidim ran their own ticket in Warsaw and other places. That they did not go along with. So if you're looking at the Orthodox parties, and let's say in Warsaw, you had the Aguda, you had Mizrahi, and you also had the Alexander Hasidim who ran on their own list. We're told that the Babover Rebbe was killed. The Babover Rebbe, I thought the Babover Rebbe survived the Holocaust. Didn't Ben Sion of Babover Rebbe survived? Or that's the son of the Babover Rebbe, the one who later becomes the Rebbe. I'll be corrected here. I don't know much about the one before him. So the one who became the Rebbe afterwards, I think his name was Shlomo, he was not the Rebbe, then you're telling me at the time. I don't know much about the Babover Hasidim. Well, there was others who were killed. Of course, there were those who were killed, but many of the leading ones. It's not an accident that the Belzer Rebbe and the Gera Rebbe and the Lubavitcher Rebbe get out. That's not an accident. Rav Menachem Zemba, whose name was already mentioned before, he was given an opportunity to leave the Warsaw Ghetto. The resistance could have taken him out of the ghetto. This is not some bub meisel you read an art scroll or anything. This is the fact. He was given a chance to leave the ghetto, and he refused to leave the ghetto. I don't know if that's an obligation to stay in the ghetto and face certain death, but he stayed in the ghetto. When we get to Reb Menachem Zemba, we'll have to deal not only with his life, but with his role in the ghetto, because the story is that he encouraged the rebellion, and he was big in terms of the joining the non-Orthodox and the Orthodox to fight against the Germans, and the some Haredim reject this and claim it's impossible that he never would have encouraged a rebellion because that's suicide. Well, let's end here tonight, everyone. We will not meet next Thursday, next Monday, because I'll be away, but we will pick up. 2 weeks, and that'll be the last class. I know this is going longer than other classes, and as I said, I think there'll be one, maybe one and a half, two more classes on Rabbah Chanan, and I hope you find it that I'm not dragging it out. I do think that although it's taken longer than the other classes, the other course sections we've done, everything we've dealt with has been relevant, not just to Rabbah Chanan, but larger issues. And as we get into some of Rabbah Chanan's theology and views of rabbinic literature, I think you'll find the same thing. Good night, everyone.